Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
We're going to be talking about D.B. Cooper and kind of his whole thing that he did. And we've got another great guest. He has a book that came out, and it's Getting to the Truth, I Am D.B. Cooper. And his name is Joe Koenig. Thank you for being here, Joe.
You're welcome. Nice to be here.
So Joe, let's talk about your history and you. Let's tell the audience you've got a lot of history and knowledge that you're putting into this book. So let's start off with you. Let the audience know who you are.
Well, I'm Joe Koenig. I retired from the Michigan State Police in 1993 after 26 years, spending almost all that time in investigations. And coincidentally, I was the lead investigator for the state police on the Hoffa case. I retired in 93, and then I went into working for a couple other public companies in investigations. And then I retired finally from Hartford Financial in 2004. And then I opened up my KMI Investigations PI firm here in Michigan in 2005, and I've been working ever since. I have one book out. My first book was called Getting the Truth, not Getting to the Truth, but Getting the Truth. And then my second book is Getting the Truth, I Am D.B. Cooper, just released.
So what inspired you to write this book? What was your interest in D.B. Cooper? And, you know, what research did you put into this?
The publisher, my publisher, Principia Media, Vern Jones is the owner. That's who I published my first book through. So I knew Vern. They received information in early 2016 from one of their editors who said, hey, I've got a source here who says he knows who D.B. Cooper is. Are you interested? So that led to a couple meetings down in Florida. And then Vern, once he realized that there was substance to this source on D.B. Cooper, he called me in because of my investigative experience and expertise, and I picked it up and ran with it. So I became active in this about mid-2016. And what I had was 3.5 hours of mini cassettes that weren't even dated or numbered. So we had no idea what order they were in. But those 10 mini cassettes contained taped recordings of discussions between Carl Loren, mm-hmm. who was the source and was the best friend of Walt Recca. And those two became friends back in 1958 when both of them belonged to a skydiving club in Saginaw, Michigan. And they found an airport there, an airport owner who would allow them to jump out of planes, which it was hard to find someone who ran an airport who would allow that. But they did, and they did a lot of jumps, experimenting with different parachutes. I think they even dropped out at 800 feet at some point, trying a little contest to figure out who could come closest to the earth before the chute opened. So they were crazy. They became very, very good friends, as did all of them in that group. And Carl, right after the incident occurred in 1971, November 24th, 1971, he saw a program that described what happened, and he felt immediately that it could have been Walt Recca could have been D.B. Cooper. So he worked. He had no contact with Walt at that time. So several years passed, and then they finally got together, and Carl started prying Walt for more information. Walt wouldn't give anything up, but he finally did. And then Carl got permission to record conversations. And over the course of about 4 or 5 months, beginning in 2008, Carl recorded conversations with Walt, wherein Walt confessed to being D.B. Cooper and gave many, many, many details that we think only the hijacker would have known. So then I took those mini cassette tapes and to do a forensic linguistics analysis on it, I had to have it transcribed. And then it took literally weeks to refine that, to bring it to the standard I needed to really do some good analysis. So I did. And over those 2 years, I not only did that analysis, I read from the FBI vault all the FBI 302 reports and the evidence they had published. We found two other witnesses that I went and interviewed, actually three witnesses that I interviewed, and also did analysis of their interviews. And in short, everything checked out. Walt's information was corroborated by what would appear to be independent witnesses. The details that only the other person present would have known. And in comparing the evidence the FBI has published with the information that Walt provided in his confession, I think there's amazing similarities in the conversations and the series of events that occurred. So I'm convinced Walt Recca is D.B. Cooper.
Now, Joe, in all fairness, you know, me and Al, we've done several shows on D.B. Cooper, and there's a lot of people that have confessed to being D.B. Cooper, and they're able to, you know, give some general details. What did Walt say to you that kind of changed your mind or convinced you that this one out of this whole lineup is the one?
Well, good question. There are a lot of things. For instance, he says he landed. Well, his conversations with the stewardess were very, very specific. And the chain of events that he describes, as far as I know, weren't known to the public beforehand. Now, I should tell you that Walt died in 2014.
Oh,
and,
man.
He is,
that's too bad.
Yeah. And
I'd like to have him on the show.
Part of the reason this wasn't released until now, actually in May of this year, is because Carl made an agreement with Walt that he wouldn't use it until after Walter's death. So, but one of the couple of the interesting things that occurred was Walt described he jumped out of the plane having strapped just one parachute to his back. He had a raincoat that he stuffed the money inside, put the belt that he had on his pants around the raincoat, and then stuffed the money into his raincoat while he had it on after he had strapped on the parachute, and then buttoned the raincoat all the way up. And then he jumped out the rear of the 727. He landed in a field, actually hit a dead tree and broke his leg.
Ooh.
Near Cleellum, Washington. He described as he was about to land, he saw some lights in the distance. And so once he landed, got himself together, took his parachute off, just covered it with branches, didn't bury it, just covered it with branches. And again, it was cold and rainy. He took his raincoat off and then put all the money back into it and then rolled it up and put it under his arm and began walking toward the lights that he saw in the distance. As he was walking with that raincoat under his arm in the rain, cold, he is passed by a truck, a dump truck, that eventually pulls into what appears to be a restaurant down the road. Walt then continues to walk to that restaurant, walks in, orders a coffee, sees a guy there who's dressed in cowboy gear and has a guitar. Walt asked the guy, if I call a friend to pick me up, will you give him directions? And he goes to the phone in the restaurant, which is now identified as the Tiana Way Cafe, that burned down probably 10 years ago, and there's a fire station there now. And there's more to that story, how the restaurant was located. But he asked this guy dressed as cowboy to tell his friend where he is so that his friend can pick him up. And cowboy does that. And then cowboy leaves because he's doing he's in a concert that night at the Grange Hall. He's a singer, and he's a pretty good one, by the way. Walt gives those details in his statement in 2008. In 2013, Carl, after just before Walt dies, Carl tries to figure out with all the details Walt provided. And Carl is a pilot. He's a commercial pilot, a very bright man. Not an investigator, but a very bright man, and knows how to read charts. He's got a son who's in the airline industry. And together they figure out, based upon what Walt has provided them, an area where he probably landed. And also in the descriptions that Walt gives on how his buddy, a guy by the name of Don Brennan, mm-hmm. who drove down from his house, the directions he took to get there helped them as well. So what Carl did was he called a restaurant that appeared to be in the area and described to the woman who answered what he was looking for. He's looking for a restaurant, kind of like a truck stop, that was on a particular road.
Yes, and somewhere where he can blend in.
Yeah, well, I don't think he had much choice on where he landed, but because in those the parachutes in those days, they're non-directional. But at any rate, she tells him, "Well, you must be talking about the Tienaway Cafe." And so she describes that. She says, "But that burned down 7 or 8 years ago. There's a fire station there now." So Carl, on his own, flew down into that area, went to that fire station, and then noticed there was a repair shop, an auto repair shop across the street. It looked like it had been there for a while. And he went across the street and he said, "Hey, by any chance, do you know a guy who dresses like a cowboy, plays in a band, and drives a drum truck?" The guy said, "No." He said, "But talk to the town historian." So we set him up, and Carl went and talked to the historian, asked the same question. The guy said, "No, but maybe my son does." And so Carl left his phone number and name and then had to leave the area. And a week later, a guy calls up Carl and says, "Hey, I understand you're looking for me." Turns out this guy is Cowboy. And he's not just a guy. He's a well-respected guy from the area, former police officer. Just named in 2017, he was named King Cole for that area, which is a high honor. So Carl talks to him, and Carl says, "Hey, by any chance, do you remember back in 1971, Thanksgiving Eve, being in a restaurant and talking to a guy?" He says, "Yeah, as a matter of fact, I do." And he gave the exact details that Walt had given Carl earlier. So now we've got Cowboy identified. Also, in the discussion with Walt, Walt talked about once he got back home, what Walt did was he lived in Heartline, Washington, and on the day of the day before the skyjacking, he drove his car to Spokane, parked his car in a parking lot, took a bus from Spokane to Portland, where he stayed overnight in a motel that he described pretty well that we think we've located. And then the next day he pulled off the skyjacking. He gave details on that. But after he landed, was retrieved by Don Brennan, taken back home, Walt worked as a welder at the Cooley Dam. And the next day, he walked into work, and then they noted that he had a broken leg, so they sent him to the doctor, the company doctor, and the doctor said, "Hey, this isn't a recent break." I think it was a couple days later that he had to report to work, but he felt it was important to report to work. Anyway, he went back to work. The doctor said it was an old injury, but he repaired it. So the doctor repaired the leg, and then Walter went about his work at the Cooley Dam. Now, he took some of his money, $200,000, and used $20 bills. Right. First of all, he gave Don Brennan several thousand dollars for picking him up. But then he took his money and he bought a house in Spokane, described the street it was on. He gave us an address that wasn't accurate, but, it was close enough. Same street. I think the number was wrong. And remember, he's telling Carl this about 37 years after this occurred. So we look up the address find Walt listed in the Polk, the old Polk directories at that address. And my editor finds and interviews and I think videotapes the owner of that house who sold it to Walt. And the details the owner gave us were exactly the same details as Walt gave us. Corroboration again. This guy sold Walt the house on a land contract. He always dealt cash. He says, matter of fact, if somebody came to me with even a bank check, he said, I'd send them back to the bank and tell them, bring me cash. So he only dealt in cash. So it wasn't unusual for Walt to pay him in cash. We've got a lot of corroboration.
So yeah, let me ask you this. I mean, you've said a lot here, and these are some points that are fairly common. First of all, was Walt a military man? You know, where did he learn? You know, I mean, we're talking low altitude, low opening when it comes to the parachute. And also, me and Al before the show, we were kind of discussing this, you know, with some of the money that was lost, because if I remember right, some of this money was found in a river.
Tenabar.
Yes. Would there be a chance of any type of DNA evidence today?
Well, let me hit your first question. He was had an honorable discharge from the Army, paratrooping. Okay. He was also in the Air Force Reserve Pararescue, which is a very elite squad that used to do jumps in very terrible weather conditions. Yeah. So he had lots of experience. This is a guy who jumped. He used to do jumps in Alaska. He dressed as Santa Claus and jumped at a charity event in Alaska. There are some news articles on him where he jumped dressed as Santa Claus to help generate money for these charitable events. Anyway, he had the experience that it would have taken for a guy to survive a jump like this. And actually, somebody asked me about the broken leg. It wasn't unusual for Walt
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Work with a broken leg. He had, Carl told us that he made a jump in Saginaw where he broke his leg. And then they went up for a second jump, and Walt went and jumped with a broken leg. So the guy was unbelievable. So he had a great deal of training as a paratroop. Now, the Tenabar money, we don't have a good explanation for that. He gave Don Brennan several thousand dollars to pick him up. Now, it's possible it's some of the money that Don Brennan would receive, but we don't have a real good explanation for that. We have some theories, but not good enough to survive. You know, they're not as credible as all the other evidence we have.
Right.
Yeah.
So, okay, if he got medical treatment for the broken leg, because, man, I want to find D.B. Cooper. And it seems, yeah, you know, that the going trend today is DNA evidence. During his treatment for this broken leg, did they take blood tests, or did they take any type of samples that we can definitively say, hey, this is the DNA of D.B. Cooper? And if we could, how would we match that to Walt?
Well, Kevin, you know, this is 1971.
I know.
DNA wasn't even a thought in investigators' minds.
Oh,
let alone
it's
killing the FBI's
me.
Minds. They, you know, they had excellent DNA evidence in the Raleigh cigarettes. By the way, Walt smoked Raleigh cigarettes. In the Raleigh cigarettes, they confiscated it off the plane where the hijacker was sitting. But that would be good DNA evidence. However, when you pick up DNA evidence or something like a cigarette or something damp, if you don't store it correctly, it'll destroy itself. You know, it'll contaminate, and it's worthless. In this case, the last I read, the FBI lost the Raleigh cigarettes that were confiscated on the plane. And so those are no longer available. Now, there was some DNA evidence supposedly on the tie that was left behind in the plane. But that wouldn't be as good as those cigarettes, because only the skyjacker smoked those cigarettes, whereas the tie could have been, you know, worn by many different people.
True.
And we're told that the DNA was not of the type that was particularly definitive. So unlike the cigarettes would have been perfect. Well, so, you know, I'm sure we could find some blood samples from Walt. If we found DNA evidence, by all means, go for it.
Mm-hmm. So what about the witnesses, people that were on the plane with him? How many of those are still living, and did you get an opportunity to speak with any of the witnesses who could, you know, perhaps, you know, I mean, this is, like you said, 1971. If we had a photograph or a photographic lineup of Walt today, do you think that they would be able to identify him from a photo lineup?
It's possible. We've got some pictures of Walt back when in 1972, 71-ish. Probably 72-ish. So it's possible, yeah. But remember, you know, we're in Michigan, and all that stuff is out there out west, and it takes money. Vern Jones funded a lot of this, but there was a lot of this I would have liked to have, you know, done more work on, but because of expenses, you know, we didn't. My point in my book, that, by the way, has endorsements from judges, the former number two in charge of the FBI, Kathleen McChesney, Jim Esposito, who worked the Hoffa case with me, from the FBI special agent in charge of New Jersey office, the former Inspector General for Social Security, who was an SAC for special agent in charge of Secret Service, federal former U.S. attorneys. I have reviewed my book and given me their stamp of approval, their endorsement that this is a case the FBI should review, because this is a very compelling case for Walt Recca to be D.B. Cooper.
Yes.
Well, so I urge you to pick up my book.
I was just, did you ever find out why he did it?
Yeah, well, his niece, who was a gal by the name of Lisa Strong, asked him that, because Walt actually gave Carl dictated to Carl a confession, called it his last testament. In there is the phrase, "I am D.B. Cooper." But I didn't use that last testament in my analysis, because even though it was dictated, Carl is a guy who is not very proficient in computers. He doesn't have an email, so everything you communicate with him through his wife, who is pretty good. But Carl then took that dictation and then had a neighbor type it up for him and then took it to Walt for him to sign it. And then Walt's sister and niece talked Walt out of signing it because he was still alive, and they said, "Hey, if you sign this in front of a notary, who knows what'll happen? They could prosecute you for this." So he didn't sign it, but also because it was written by Carl, based on what he thought Walt told him, I didn't use it in my analysis. There are a lot of good details in that as well. But when his niece, Lisa, talked to Walt, "Why did you do this, Walt?" Walt told Lisa, "I'd rather be dead than poor." Walt grew up in Detroit as a kid. His dad died at a very young age. His dad was electrocuted, and Walt kind of grew up on the streets of Detroit. So had a tough childhood, and he was tired of being poor. And he pulled this off so that he could give his kids something.
What a way to do it.
Were you able to talk to the kids or any of the family?
I talked to Lisa. I haven't talked to the family.
I was just wondering if they knew about it, if they knew that that's who he was, or if he told them.
What a legacy.
There is. He was very quiet about it. There's much more to this story, because Walt had in his, and he would send all of this, he sent all of this information to Carl, all the documents, all the identifications to Carl after he opened up about being D.B. Cooper. He had identifications that were KGB identifications for Walt Recca. He had obviously fraudulent IDs where he would change the name from Walt Pica to Walt Recca with, you know, by extending the making a P into an R, And you could see the different color ink. I've got a picture of that in the book. It's just obvious.
I used to do that with my report cards.
He had, it's a very, very interesting case. The man has just an amazing history. And, you know, we've got vaccination documents that show he was vaccinated throughout these years for foreign travel. He was in Saudi Arabia. He's got a letter of commendation from the U.S., I think it's Army, on the basis of something he reported to them. I can't remember all the details right now, but he reported to them something that saved several troops' lives. And he's got a written commendation from some officer in the Army as a result. Just an amazing guy. Now, he's a petty thief. I mean, he was convicted of an armed robbery in the Detroit area of a big boy, which he was convicted of, sentenced, and then he jumped, and he was wanted for that. He never wanted to go to jail. So, you know, he had a checkered past. He had a pizza place in Wixom, Michigan for a while. He burned that down for insurance money. So he's not a choir boy by any chance. He has a Robin Hood type quality about him, because every time he does something, he usually gives the people, the workers, part of his take, part of his money. Like when he did the big boy armed robbery, he gave the manager there some money. And also on this skyjacking, he offered, he said $4,000 to the stewardess just before he jumped out.
Wow. So, in 1971, that's a lot of money.
Yeah. That's a bundle of money. And the $200,000 back then is worth, I think, a little over $1 million now. So, you know, people say, well, why do you only do it for $200,000? Well, you don't want to get too heavy when you jump out of a plane. So
True. Because if he was a military man, he would understand that, you know, the packs that you have to drop before you actually hit ground don't weigh much more than 110 pounds.
Yeah. Now, I urge the FBI to take a look at the evidence we have, and it's very, very compelling. If they have detailed conversations, you know, a lot of the people are dead and gone, so they're not available. But if they have in their 302 some good detailed reports about conversations, they'll be able to compare them to what Walt gave us here and solve their case, I think.
Do you think that they'll actually close it and solve it this way, or do you think they're going to want more? Or it seems like some of the old cases, they really kind of take their time on.
Yeah, well, I would want more if I were the Bureau, before I would make sure. But they've suspended their case. I think in 2016 they suspended it. But, you know, they may. I hope they take a look at Kathleen McChesney, who is like the number two at the FBI. I'm not sure that was with Mueller, or it might have been Louis Freeh. But Jim Esposito, former special agent in charge. I got federal prosecutors, John Smetanka, former U.S. attorney. They think it's worth taking a close look at, yes.
Now, have you heard anything from the D.B. Cooper community? Because I know that they're quite vocal. And have you heard any opinions or feedback yet?
Yeah, they have the following.
Well, Yeah. I haven't talked to him, but our producer has, Vern Jones has, and Dirk Wieringa have. Matter of fact, they went to the CooperCon here earlier in the year.
CooperCon. I've not heard that yet.
Yeah. And made a presentation along with all the others. But by far, our case, I think, of course, each of them thinks their case is, but we're not manipulating any evidence to prove that this is D.B. Cooper. We're simply letting the evidence that Walt gave us and the investigation we conducted and my analysis speak for itself. So we're letting the evidence drive our conclusion and not a preconception driving our conclusion.
Did you get any impression of how Walt felt about getting away with it?
Walt, you know, part of my analysis, I listened to the recordings 3.5 hours several times. And one of the things, part of the forensic analysis is to, in addition to the words the people use, and in this case, I didn't have a videotape, just an audible. But you listen for voice inflections, volume, how quickly they respond to a question. Are there inordinate pauses? Are there any inconsistencies in his communication, be it just the audible portion? Are there any inconsistencies there that or communication patterns that change during that 3.5 hours? So that's primarily what I was looking for as I listened to those tapes. And he was amazingly consistent throughout. His attitude was more of a guy who was kind of embarrassed about it, not bragging about it at all. He was very, very downplayed any brilliance on his part, saying that really he didn't have a plan at all. He just did it. That he didn't read about it. He wanted to forget about it. And he was reluctant to confess to it, but he finally did to his best friend, Carl, because Carl was such a good, trusted, loyal friend. He said, "I just can't lie to you anymore, Carl." So that's the reason he gave it up to Carl.
Pretty interesting. Well, what other impressions did you get from listening and analyzing his voice?
Well, I didn't analyze his voice other than to listen for communication patterns. So I like to listen to, you know, does he emphasize one word more than another? What kinds of words does he use? Does he use informal phrases in his speech as he's moving on when he's talking about, I mean, do those, you know, typically you'll see informal phrases in low stress situations where it's an informal discussion between you and a friend, for example, about something that isn't threatening. Now, you would expect that as the stress goes up, or as you talk about something that you're lying about, for instance, you might be less inclined to be consistently using those informal phrases. So I listened to what words he used, how he used them, how he pronounced them, his breathing, the pauses between once the question was asked and the answer was given. There's a lot you can tell from listening to that with that analysis in mind to see if there are changes in how he responds. And it's those changes that a forensic linguist really looks for. That's what I look for.
Inconsistencies.
You kind of get a fix on their communication pattern. And then you look for changes in those patterns. And then you try to explain what caused that change. Was it a loud noise? Was it he suddenly got somebody knocked on his front door? Was it deception? you know, that sort of thing. You have to then drill down and try to figure out the reason behind the communication pattern change. There is a reason, just have to find it.
So have you got a website or something that people can find you on if they have any comments or want to review your stuff?
I do. Of course, the book is the best source, but my website is www.kmiinvestigations.com, all one word, kmiinvestigations.com. Two I's together and an S on the end.
Fantastic. Now, so we'll have your book linked as well and your site on our website so people can just go one click, pick up the book, find out the details on all your information. What have you got planned next?
Well, I'm doing some book readings here. We just released it last week, so I had a book reading at a large bookstore here in Grand Rapids last Wednesday, another one last Thursday in Ann Arbor, and then I've got one tomorrow at a bookstore in Okemos, Michigan, Schuler's Books. And then I'm doing a number of interviews.
Busy, busy. Well, I really appreciate you coming on the show, talk about the book, your research, information. Our guest, Joe Koenig, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Alan and Kevin. Thank you.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.